Welcome to another episode of The Gateway. My name is Russ, and as always, I am joined by my co-hosts Amin and Biagio. For this episode of The Gateway, we are excited to welcome Dr. Mahesh Subramani, a presidential research professor and professor of management at Northern Illinois University. His research program is currently dedicated to understanding how frontline workers are being affected by a perfect storm of social, economic, ecological, and technological forces, and how service work can be positively transformed to benefit workers, customers, organizations, and the society at large. Mahesh's scholarly publications have appeared in leading business journals, including Journal of Applied Psychology, Journal of Management, Journal of Organizational Behavior, Academy of Management Journal, Human Resource Management, and the Journal of Service Research. Mahesh is on the editorial board of prominent journals including Human Resource Management, Human Resource Management Journal, Journal of Organizational Behavior, and Journal of Business and Psychology. Mahesh has served as associate editor for Journal of Business Research, Journal of Service Management, and Journal of Service Research. Mahesh, welcome to The Gateway. It is such a pleasure to have you today.
Great to see you, Russ.
We have been very excited about this conversation, and I say that with every guest, but like there's always ones that you just connect with, and your background, your research, your whole career is something that I've admired and just been really enthralled with. So I'm excited for this conversation, but I want to start at the beginning and really broadly, how did you get to where you are?
That's a great question, Russ. So I can give you a long version or the short version. Which one would you like?
We like both versions. Okay. Yeah. Whatever you're comfortable with.
So because the focus of this conversation is mostly on the research piece, so let me give you sort of an amalgam of the short and the long version, right? Perfect. So my interest is in services. So specifically, I look at how organizations, employees, and customers interact with each other and what makes that relationship as positive as it possibly can be. So we have multiple instances of things going wrong. So for instance, an organization is delivering a service and that is not, you know, liked by the customer, service failure. I don't look at that as much. What I look at is what are some things that organizations can do to make customers' lives better. Similarly, what can organizations do to make employees' lives better? And how can there be a positive relationship between employees and customers as well, correct? So that's the big, broad piece. So that's sort of what I have focused on for the last 25 years, right?
Yes.
So that's a quarter century for those of you who are trying to figure out, you know, how old I am. So that's sort of how that works. Now, the story of how it all began really goes back to, you know, my days back in India, decades ago when I just graduated with a master's degree and I was looking for a job. And there was this new place that opened up and it was called Customer Satisfaction Management and Measurement, which was a division of the Indian Market Research Bureau. And they were looking for somebody who would be able to examine the relationship between frontline employees and customers. So again, I'm talking about the early 1990s. And that was a time when the service revolution had just taken over the United States. Ron Zemke had published his book, and CEO and founder of Scandinavian Airlines had written a book called Moments of Truth. And all of this was really talking about how it's important for, you know, organizations to create strong relationships between employees and customers, because that kind of keeps the customers coming back and things of that nature, right? And so this organization sort of took that idea and they built a small practice around what they called quality culture. So what they said is, if an organization creates a culture that is conducive to employee productivity and well-being, there's a high likelihood employees will behave in ways that will satisfy customers. Now, in order to investigate that relationship between what employees were doing and what customers were doing, what this company, what this organization asked me to do was to go to various organizations and conduct focus groups. And what would happen is I would conduct these focus groups with employees, and they would say a bunch of things. They would say things like, you know, we wanted to close we're supposed to close our, American Express branch at 5 p.m., but we had this customer who came in and who really needed, some traveler's checks at 4:55, but my supervisor said, ask him to come tomorrow, and I felt really terrible about it, right? So that would be a story, for instance, that the employees would tell me. Well, what was really interesting is that I had access to their supervisors and their customers. So the next day I would have a conversation with the supervisors, and the supervisors would talk about a policy or procedure that they had created in order to keep their employees safe. And they had to be shut by a certain point of time just so that these employees could get out and, so that their well-being would be enhanced. But the employees were perceiving that as an obstacle. And then customers would sort of talk about the same thing from a different angle. And so I was really fascinated by this. And so I decided to make that the topic of my PhD. And so in my PhD, I kind of looked at, how employees and customers interacted with each other, specifically in a private sector corporation, Xerox, and what were, empowered teams of employees, how they were able to sort of enhance that customer satisfaction, customer loyalty. Fast forward, so I did that for some time, and then I went off to the private sector and spent 5 years in the private sector not doing any of this research, but basically looking at human resource management stuff, right? Then I came back, became an academician, and I sort of re-examined my interest in that, or rather reignited my interest in customer satisfaction. And so then for another 10 years or so, I did research looking at what we call the service profit chain. So we look at the relationship between, how organizations treat their employees and how employees treat their customers and how the customers go out and sort of spend money, and that leads to profitability. So the service profit chain, the entire link. And I was testing that model, that linkage model, using multiple measurement tools, analytics, and things of that nature. So I did that for a while. All the time, while I was engaged in this research, I was also connecting with companies. So there's a company called Manpower that has, it's a staffing company. So I did some work with them. And what they would do essentially is pay me in data, as opposed to pay me in money. So I took that data and published a few papers based on, my research there. Follett Higher Education Group, which is the company that manages bookstores. I did some work for them on their secret shopper process, and they gave me some data, and so on and so forth. And so what I've done in the last, 10, 12, 15 years, I guess, is interacted with the industry to help them solve their problems using my analytical expertise, but then using that data to also publish papers I've been lucky to have been published in some decent journals, right? Using that. So my research, once again, if I were to sort of summarize it, it looks at that reciprocal relationship between organizations, employees, and customers. But what it has also done is that it allows me to bridge the gap between what we do as scientists and what folks in the real world do, right? So it's a bridge building enterprise that I have been engaged in for a while. So that's sort of my story. And then I have another story, which is the shorter, much more interesting story, which sort of spans from 2021 to now. And I can tell that story later.
Perfect. So part two of this story, we're going to remember for that one. Because I'm now like, that's a great cliffhanger. I'm like, okay, yeah. I'm interested. So as you're working in this bridge capacity, I think a lot of people's interactions with human resources as a whole in their experience, at least in the Western world and specifically in America, it tends to be, I got hired with this person. I talked to him one time. I really impressed him. And then I never talked to him again because that person isn't who I work for. And I needed some time off, or a family issue came up. And then I quit. I got fired, I got let go, like the negative side of those things. Is that, does that mentality hinder your work when you're potentially coming in as maybe a tangential representative of a company's HR? Like, do you have obstacles to break down even though you're maybe not invested in that side of things? You're not looking at their performance. You don't necessarily, quote unquote, care about it like maybe their actual day-to-day manager or the company. You're just trying to get data about what's going on. Is that something you encounter?
No, that's a really great question. So I've been on both sides of the fence. So I was in HR for 5 years. And, you know, I managed their, you know, at Ford Motor Company, I did a lot of selection, employee selection, and did some change management there. And then at Whirlpool Corporation, I did a lot of work around change management, engagement surveys, 360-degree feedback, and so on and so forth. And so I've done that part. And then I've done this other piece where I come in from outside to kind of help organizations figure out what's going on with their employees. And I would say in both those situations, I think the one thing that is common is my ethical obligation. So I'm an organizational psychologist by training, and you know, we have a code of ethics. And I follow that code of ethics very strongly. So for instance, anonymity is one major part of our you know, ethical guidelines. So not letting, you know, whoever it is, whether it's my manager or whether it's my client, I will not let them know who said what. So that is clear. In fact, I have a short story if you're interested. So yes. Many years ago when I was working at Ford Motor Company, I had a boss who called me to her office, and she was trying to create some change in the recruiting function. And she called me and she sort of said, you know, I have a request from you because you're such a, so she first flattered me. She spent about 10 minutes telling me how great I was. And I was a younger person then, and I was prone to flattery, I guess. And then I sort of heard her out. I was like, oh, that's pretty cool. I'm pretty cool too. Then she sort of said, well, I need some help. I need your organizational psychology expertise. And I said, why, how? And she sort of said, I really want to know what people are saying about me. So I said, oh, I would be happy to create a 360-degree feedback process for you so that you can get anonymous feedback. She said, no, I don't want anonymous. I want to know who's saying what about me. And so I sort of looked at her and I sort of said, you know, I said, oh, I completely understand what you want, but that's something which I would have absolutely done for you if I did not have a PhD in this topic. And then I am beholden to a set of, you know, to an ethical code. So that's one example of how that ethical code sort of, you know, is important. The other piece, so that's anonymity, right? So that's one part of it. The other part of it is first doing no harm. So what happens is that if you look at management practice, there are a lot of things out there that are just, you know, witchcraft. I mean, it's not really evidence-based, you know, or science-based. So
it feels good.
It feels great, right? So you can go to an airport bookstore and you can find things like, you know, lead like Attila the Hun, right? And like, why would I want to rule, you know, lead like Attila the Hun, right? But the idea, once again, is that there are so many things out there where people have written stories about their own lives, executives typically, and they propose and purport, you know, these big theories. But those theories are not grounded in any fact, right? And so one of the things that I feel from an ethical obligation perspective is to make sure that I'm only saying things that are based in data. And by data, I mean data that is systematically collected, systematically analyzed, and not exploited for a specific purpose. So using engagement surveys, for example, to answer only the questions that those surveys were supposed to answer and not sort of overgeneralizing from it, right? So that's the second piece, which is a very core part of what I do. So anonymity, and then there is this idea of being evidence-based. And again, I have another story if you're interested.
Please.
I had a situation where I was working with this organization and they wanted to basically get rid of one of their contractors. And they thought that the data that I would get them would help make the case to get rid of the contractor. But actually, the data showed that the contractor was doing a pretty good job. So in other words, there was a strong correlation between, you know, the mystery shoppers that the contractor was sending into the stores and the actual customer satisfaction and sales scores, right? Uh-huh. And I was able to show that. And then the company was able to make the decision to actually keep the contractor.
Oh, now, very good.
So the idea was there. So I'm not good. I know this is what you want, mm-hmm. but this is what the data is telling us. So, and to do that in the most persuasive kind of a manner, right? So that's the second part of the conduct, right? And which I have searched, yeah. which I've done, regardless of whether I was an internal consultant within a company or whether I was an external consultant. The third piece has to do with, you know, the importance of theory. Now, what's happening now is that we have a lot of availability of data out there. So 10, mm-hmm. 15 years ago, if I wanted data from a company, there was only very limited amount of information. So for example, most companies were not tracking turnover, right? But mm-hmm. all this data is now available, right? So if a company releases that information to me, I can pretty much look for anything and make a case for anything. What do I mean by that? Well, many, many decades ago, there was this term that was used. It was called Dust Bowl empiricism, right? So there were a couple of universities in the Dust Bowl, that is in Oklahoma. And what they used to do is that they used to get these large data sets, and then they would look for anything that was significant in those relationships. If they found, you know, and they would say, oh, that's significant. Let's publish that, right? Now, the problem with that kind of an approach with Dust Bowl empiricism is that a lot of these relationships can be quite random, and they become statistically significant just because you have very large sample sizes. Again, I'm getting a little technical, but really,
no, what you're saying talking is that correlation yeah. isn't causation.
Right? Correlation is not causation, and correlation is much more complex than you think because there are multiple correlates, right? So that correlation is within a larger constellation of correlations, right? And so what happens is when you ask questions, research questions that are well thought through, and then propose a theoretical explanation for it, and then go out and collect data and come up with results, you are more likely to be not just fact-based, but you also have an actual argument on the mechanisms through which something affects something else, right? But what you find, especially with this new trend in data science, is that people are looking for random correlations and covariances. And then on the basis of those correlations and covariances, they come to major conclusions regarding what companies should do or should not do. So for instance, if turnover is strongly correlated with, let's say, the distance of between the person and their, you know, between their work and their home, they are going to essentially propose that, you know, get people to move closer to the company, right? But that is an indication really of, you know, community sense or the sense of, you know, to the extent to which the person is embedded within the community. So you have to directly measure community embedment and then see, look at the correlation. And if the correlation bumps up, then you know that that's the construct that's really working here in this particular situation. So in other words, what I do, so that's number three, right, is to make sure that I have good theory. I explain the theory to the managers, and then when I collect the data, then I'm able to say, look, this was our theory. This is what we proposed would happen, and this is what happened, or it did not happen. So let's try a different alternative, a different way of looking at that data. And does that make sense? So those are three things that I try to do regardless of the kind of project I'm involved in, whether it's an academic project or an applied project, internal, external, to make sure that I have a certain code of conduct that is based in my identity as a scientist. And then I try to use that in practice. Is that, wow. I hope that makes sense.
That completely does. And I'm going to ask maybe, since we're talking ethics and those things, I'm going to ask a little bit of a difficult question. Yeah. And I'm not even sure if you've thought about this, but someone like yourself comes into a company, you're a contractor. A lot of times there's some type of an agreement, whether it's, hey, we'll provide this data, I'll publish this one, a mutually beneficial goal and mission. Yeah. Is there a time that or not even specific, but have you kind of experienced where the research and the results you've been able to provide that company has resulted in maybe your perceived improvement of that company in a way that you like is almost shot. Like you're almost jealous. Like you're yes. like, wait, hold on. You all went from like $100,000 company and I gave you some help and now it's $1 billion and you're kind of sitting over here. Like I yeah. should have maybe been there. Like, I'm not trying to be rude. I understand. Like, but yeah. is that something difficult yeah, yeah. to kind of navigate?
Absolutely. If your question is the question of impact, I'm always looking for those opportunities where the work that I do has some direct relevance to yeah. you know, policy and practice. So I can give an example of a company that we just completed work with, and this is Southwest Airlines. I can talk about them. We just culminated a 4-year project with Southwest, in which we looked at customer mistreatment of flight attendants. And so this was a project that started off early 2020.
Is that meaning like customers mistreating the flight attendants?
Yeah,
or
yeah.
Okay, understanding.
Thank you for the clarification. So every time I say customer mistreatment or customer incivility, what I really mean is customers being bad. Okay.
Perfect.
So really, this project began with the director of in-flight operations at Southwest sort of reaching out and saying, well, you know, we have all these situations of passengers really behaving rudely and badly with flight attendants during COVID-19. And she sort of said, can you help me figure out what's causing it? And so that kind of led me to a pretty large project. Again, I said, it's been about 4 years. We've collected lots and lots yeah. of data. But around 2022, early 2022, we had the results and then we, you know, delivered that to Southwest. And one of the recommendations that we had was, you know, develop a professional development program for your flight attendants so that they can have higher levels of engagement, but also know how to sort of tackle, you know, mistreatment from customers. And they essentially turned around and said, yeah, we'd love to do that. We just wish we had help. And so what we then did is there was a small group that was created. So this was four employees from Southwest and then myself and my graduate assistant partner in crime. And so the six of us essentially sat down and we sort of created a training or professional development program for Southwest. And then over time, over a period of one and a half years, three different modules of their professional development program was rolled out to all their flight attendants. So all 17,000 flight attendants went through that professional development program. And we did not charge them a cent. So it was completely done for free. And the reason we did it is because we knew that, you know, we preach all of this.
Mm-hmm.
We always talk about interventions, but we don't do those interventions. And we wanted to see if those interventions, A, can be created, and B, whether they work. So what we then did is we connected each one of those modules with some data collection. And so that data, so now we have longitudinal data within that organization, which has to do with how do employees respond to customer mistreatment and incivility? And then what does that do for them later in terms of their engagement levels and stress and things of that nature? So it gave us the data that we needed now, and it gave the company an opportunity to actually intervene. And when we conducted focus groups with these flight attendants, they were all very grateful. Now, did they learn anything in those professional development programs? It's like Biagio and my class, right? Our students, right? I mean, they love those classes.
Yep.
I just don't know if they're really transformed as human beings, right? But the idea once again, I'm just half kidding. There's hopefully there's some learning.
Yeah. Right,
but,
of course.
But what I'm saying is that those flight attendants felt really seen.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that in itself is an intervention. So what you've done is you've sort of said, mm-hmm. Well, let's help you develop some skills. And they're responding not to the fact that we're giving them some skills, but they're responding to the fact that, oh, you care so much for us that you really want us to gain some new skills. And that then drives engagement levels.
You're going Does back to sense? the assembly line and changing the light.
The Hawthorne right, like experiments. The, Wonderful. It,
yes. Okay. Just yeah. knowing that someone cares. Can
yes.
be just as impactful.
That can be as impactful. So to answer your question, I guess, is that, yes, it's wonderful to see the recommendations that we make getting translated into actual interventions. And no, it does not create any sense of angst or jealousy or anything of that sort, even if no money has changed hands.
Very cool.
What it does is it gives me a sense of accomplishment, because this is what I'm really doing. I'm actually having a real life, sort of real world impact, I guess.
Yeah. Wow.
Russ, I kind of want to jump in. I don't know, we are 20 minutes in, and I think everybody can already tell how much Mahesh is passionate about research, how much his research is rigorous and is leading to real world impact, which, I mean, again, it's very impressive. And I wish we had him earlier, because some of the stuff he mentioned, like, they are like super, super smart. And I think I can apply on my research as well. I think my question for Mahesh is, have you ever considered, like, okay, this example of Southwest is perfect for me, right? So you developed this, and as you said, you did it for free because you were not even sure if it was working or not. But in a scenario where you guys, as you said, have data that support that has a real impact and value, have you ever considered then potentially being becoming something like a business or something that you go and sell to other airlines? Yeah. And say, hey, look, this is the impact that he had for Southwest. What do you think about that? Because especially the problem that you went to Tegel and people being rude on the airplane is something that from pandemic now on is escalating. Like, we've seen videos of fights and like crazy stuff happening on the air, right? Maybe we didn't hear or listen before. So it's definitely something that you're tackling is very important, and many other companies and airlines can benefit from.
No, that's a really good question. So there are two pieces to what you just said. One is commercialization. And the second is scaling up the impact, right? So those are typically things that we tend to think of in tandem. So we sort of think of, as you commercialize, you also scale up, right? Now, the question really here is, you know, can you scale up without commercializing? Right? And I think when it comes down to academic research, I think I'm quite old-fashioned that way. So I tend to not commercialize, but I like to scale up. And some folks call it giving away your research. It's not a question of giving away your research. It's really a question of values. So I'm in this field. I was in the private sector, Biagio, and I finally caught up with the money I lost by leaving private sector only about, I think, 8 years ago. So, you know, it took me that long.
Wow.
So in other words, it was a huge monetary, from a financial perspective, it was not lucrative for me to leave the private sector, but I did. So now that I left it and I walked into academics, I did that with a specific purpose in mind. And that purpose very clearly was to be in perpetually a state of flow or engagement.
Ooh, you just said flow. Okay.
A flow, right? So the idea, and as if you remember the idea of flow, you need to have high levels of difficulty and high levels of ability. And flow emerges somewhere in the middle, right? So if you have high levels of difficulty without high levels of ability, then you have stress. If you have high levels of ability but low levels of difficulty, then you have boredom. Flow is somewhere in between, right? And for me, it was important to be in that point where I would have flow. And what does that mean, practically speaking? It means that I actually count the number of hours every week where I was engaged. I do not count the number of hours I worked. I only count the number of hours I was engaged. And I have come to the conclusion, I think I've come to this point now in my career where the correlation is almost perfect. So I have come to a point where I don't, and this is the beauty of our jobs, right? That we don't have to do the nonsense as much. And I've finally found the place where 90 to 95% of the time I'm in flow. It's almost like being an athlete who is constantly working on their running or their basketball and so on and so forth, right? And I find that thinking about money gets in the way of that flow. And it's just phenomenal. And this is just me, folks. I'm not saying this. I always tell my story to people and say, don't try this at home. But for me, I think the process of working on something and being truly engaged in it is much more important than what happens afterward and what I get. So when I scale up, I'm increasing the difficulty levels, and I'm also finding opportunities to increase my own skill levels. So every time something new happens in the world, I try to learn it. So for instance, when it comes down to lit reviews, I used to do literature reviews the old-fashioned way, but then I moved to bibliometric analysis, and now I use structural thematic analysis, right? Essentially, AI-based tools, right, to do literature reviews. Again, I'm learning new things every single day, and that's increasing my ability levels, and then also exposing myself to more and more things so that my difficulty levels increase, and then my flow levels again reach. So I center again, right? So that's, I don't know. I hope this was not that abstract, but what I'm trying to say is that the intrinsic motivation for me is a lot more important than the commercialization piece. Having said that, other folks can absolutely go that way, and that's absolutely fine for them.
Mahesh, how do you define engaged? Like, and I know not for everyone, but when you're looking at, okay, I'm just doing the work. It's the things that we just have to do. And then when do you define, okay, now I'm engaged in my work?
Yeah. So one part of engagement is absorption. And so that's what this is what that flow piece is. So full attention, complete attention, complete presence is one way in which I define engagement. So I'm physically standing here, and I'm physically standing, and this is all I have right now in this world. I don't have anything else going on in this world, right? And that's what happens with us when we are in class, for example, right? So when we are sort of there, and then we come to this point where a student just moves their eyes there, and we know it happened. Because we have our consciousness has expanded and has included everybody around us. So that's the first part, right? So that's the whole flow piece or absorption piece. The second piece is risk-taking, right? So I'm willing to be authentic and genuine. So I'm able to open myself up and say, this is who I am. And I'm not afraid. I have full psychological security and safety. And I stand in there and I'm talking to you, and that's what is in me comes out, right? So that is the second piece of engagement for me. And that is so important in relationships, right? Because a lot of times when we walk into classrooms. I used to have a colleague many years ago. He was a psychology professor at a different university. And he won this award. It's called the Brewster Award, given by the APA, American Psychological Association, for the best teacher. And of the year, like APA would give it. And he won that award. I remember his speech, and his first sentence, he says that, for the last 20 years, I've been writing this column about being an effective teacher. And I've finally come to the conclusion that effective teaching is not really about tools and techniques. It's about genuinely who you are. So what a great teacher does, he says, is brings themselves fully to the classroom. And that really inspired me, I got to tell you, Rasen Biagio, because that's when I sort of came to the conclusion that I'm fooling around with the tools and techniques. That's all great. Mm-hmm. I got to do the, leave that. Can you show up? can you be there 100%? And for me, that is engagement.
Wow. That took me a moment because I think we hear those things that feel good. Again, some of those pops, like, always walk with the turtle or some random metaphor that you're like, okay, great. But like, it's going back to those things of taking your time, being present, enjoying that one. But then when you really look at that, especially in our society right now, when there's always a notification, there's always another thing, there's always an email, I can say this personally, I am probably rarely 100% present, yeah, except for when I'm sleeping, but I'm also dreaming of other stuff I should be doing. So it's a problem, but yes. I really value that. Biagio, I'm keep yeah. taking over. I'm sorry.
No. I mean, again, I think there are so many lessons we can already take for my show. I say to my students all the time, humans are not good at multitasking. And when you are in your classroom, you are like investing in yourself, in your learning, and that time is costing you money. So take advantage of it. Don't try to apply to job well while you're listening to me. You know, like, because in the end of the day, you're not going to be doing none of them at the level that you can achieve if you really right. focus on one thing at a time. That said, is like the, I think for what I can see and what Maheshin said, the level of that he has reached when it comes to these things is impressive. I don't know, I come from a different training. So I also started with customer service, working with service quality. So we have that in common,
I love
but
it.
I'm more on the technology side of things, right? Sure. So for me, there is a methodology called design science research, where we start with a problem, is a problem solving paradigm, and then we try to find build an artifact or build even a framework like you did sure. to find you know solve that problem. And in my mindset, the commercialization of that tool is always there, just maybe because I have an entrepreneurial mind. I don't know. I always yeah. thinking about that.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. But I do see how much you are genuine about it. Like your research is so outstanding, and you're working with big companies, and what you're taking out is the data, which data is money, right? But it leads to publication, which you know is a big currency for us as mm-hmm. scholars. Yep. But at the same time, the way that you are like so content and happy with just having an impact in the real world. Mm. And it's just like, it's impressive.
I'm also older. Yeah, I think that makes a difference too. And I'm only half kidding. When you think of, you know, developmental models out there, models of career development or lifespan development, you find that people have different kinds of challenges at different stages of their lives. And the part that I am in is the challenge of, you know, generativity versus, you know, stagnation. So you can come to that point in your life where you start plateauing, right? Unless you start to think about, you know, your life afresh. And for me, it's you know, I came to the conclusion a few years ago was that it's the process of mentoring, process of giving, you know, giving opportunities to others. I mean, that's really what drives me now. The projects that I pick up are obviously driven by my own passion, but they have to intersect with some good that comes from it, either for an organization or another student or whatever it might be. Otherwise I won't pick it. It's not worth it for me.
I don't want to repeat myself, but Mahesh is one of those people that makes NIU what it is, in my opinion. It's such a place where I can see everybody caring of who is around them and where the impact that you can have on our student, that, as you said, like they need that guidance, they need the mentorship to really achieve their full potential, is nowhere, it's not easy to find, let's put it that way. And I'm not talking about your research, like I'm even thinking about all your recent success as a teacher. I think they speak volumes of...
It's a big tent, Biagio, thank you. Yeah. But it's a big tent. I think we all do what we have to do within that tent, right? And we all have our own, you know, personality traits and, you know, life experiences. And we all bring that to the extent that we can to the big yeah. problem. And the big problem is a big sticky problem, Biagio. It's the problem of connection. You know, the problem that we are... you know, we have as a society today is the problem of connection, you know, connecting with each other, connecting with ourselves, with our own thoughts and emotions. And if we all play a role in at least either creating that problem or solving it, right? And right now, what we're doing here is a very human enterprise, right? You study artificial intelligence, and we know we are coming to the point where we can have a lot more sort of socio-emotional kinds of AI, right, out there. But this piece where, you know, you're hearing me and I'm hearing you, and then we are cycling back and consistently growing as people in this conversation, that's really what makes us uniquely human. This is Alison Pugh is a sociologist, and she talks about this as connective labor. And she says this is the piece that is in the danger of being taken away with technology. But when it goes away, what do we lose? I think that we lose everything, you know, what makes us human.
So connected to that, Russ, I want to jump on this because this is my observation, and I'm not following your three guidelines, which I should be doing every time I'm thinking about, you know, potential research ideas, right? With the, again, this is what I've seen, right? Mm-hmm. New generations are not communicating the way that I grew up communicating, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. I can see even just my brother that is like 13 years younger than me, writing a text to his friend, even though they are in the same rooms, right? And with AI, this whole thing, I think it can go just to the next level. Mm-hmm. How do you see, do you see, like, this becoming a problem or something that we need to just account for in terms of, you know, moving forward? Because as you said, like, humans are still going to be around humans. It's not like we're going to just have robots friends, like somebody suggesting, or fake friends, like somebody suggesting.
No, that's a really interesting observation because so every generation has said the same thing that you just did, the generation after them, there was something sort of fundamentally flawed. I would say that within the young people as well, I see a huge thirst for connection. They're not able to articulate it the way we do, but they are, the reason they're sending that text is because they want to stay connected. Now, they're defining that connection a little differently, but it's still the same human need. So that's the first, that's simply a response to that particular example. I think the bigger question here really is, in the world of work, are we in the danger? Are we in danger of losing that connectivity, that connection? And the answer is, unfortunately, a yes. And this is kind of what my second part of the story is—the cliffhanger. So this is the part. Ooh. So the last few years, I've been looking at humanity within the context of technology. So, you know, specifically on the service front lines. So when employees and customers or organizations and customers interact with each other, and technology is used as a substitute for employees or at least a process or at least a way to speed up the process of service delivery, what are customers losing and what are employees losing? Right. And one important part of that story is around platforms. So specifically platforms like, you know, ride sharing, for instance. So within ride sharing, there's this idea of algorithmic management. Right. So the fact that the algorithms are really telling the driver where to go, who to pick up, you know, how much to charge and so on and so forth. It's not a person who's telling them that. And now that sort of an algorithmic management is now transferring not just ride sharing, but from ride sharing to all kinds of platform labor and gig work, but now from gig work to regular brick and mortar work as well, right? So there's that movement. So this is all based on this idea of the efficiency paradigm. So you need to be as efficient as possible. And efficiency is only possible when you remove constraints and friction. And that constraint and friction really comes from the unpredictability of human nature. Right? So that is the danger today. So we are all facing that problem where in most jobs today and jobs of tomorrow, a lot of the friction is going to be removed. And that friction really comes from, like I said, the unpredictability of human beings to be replaced by the complete predictability of artificial intelligence algorithms and so on and so forth. So I think that is a bigger issue, Biagio. I think, you know, I'm not worried as much about students, you know, texting each other and having a conversation that way. I'm more worried about institutions creating the structures that lead work itself to fundamentally change so that the humanness is built out of it or designed out of it. So that's kind of where my work is now sort of progressing.
Just to add one more layer, like the text that you were talking about, the next level I was thinking is when you ask AI how to respond to every single human interaction, right? Responding to an email, creating an email, yeah. creating a text. I think that's what is like, because now it's embedded within, like, if you have an Apple phone, right? Every time I write a text, it's asking me, do you want me to approve it? And like, so I think I'm losing my ability. The more I'm using it, the more I feel like I'm losing skills.
Exactly.
Rather than making my
right, and you're fully formed, and so am I, and so is Russ. Yeah. But a 15-year-old or a 21-year-old is not fully formed, right? Their brain is still going through the process of. Well, we are always, you know, process of, you know, this brain plasticity, right? Regardless of the age, but the brain is a lot more plastic then, right? And I'm my greatest concern is if your first five job experiences are such that you don't have that level of human connection and interaction. Does that reshape you as a person so that, you know, you are not able, you're not capable of doing it anymore? And that's kind of what my concern is.
That seems scary. I don't know what other word.
No, we have a choice. It is scary because we believe we have no choice, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I would argue that we actually have a choice. What would be ideal is if we made those choices at the policy level, at the level of government, for instance, and moved it down. But given the fact that that's not happening, we could create our own personal code that we can abide by. So I can create a code for my classroom, for instance, or for my research group that I'm working with, right? Or for my family and friends. So if I can start to have some agency and some control, then maybe we can start to not reshape the world, but at least adapt to it a little better. Again, I always jokingly call myself a techno-pessimist. I'm not against technology. I use it as much as everybody else does. I just am pessimistic about how people are using that technology and changing the existing structure of human society. And, you know, that is more my concern. And then I feel that we should reclaim some of that power back.
Wow. It's interesting that technology might and is impacting our values, like as individual humans. And you're basically saying, hey, that's fine, but know your values. Like, I hadn't even thought of that, but like, personally, I'm not gonna use AI to respond to a significant other. Like, you know, that's a, I don't know, a goal or a rule or something.
Yes.
But like, now will I use it to send an emoji real fat, like, to them that is like there? But if it's like, oh, hey, we need to talk, that's when I'm gonna try and say, no, I need to be 100% with all the flaws, with the commas in the wrong places, all of that stuff, because it's more important for the authenticity than the accuracy.
Right.
Exactly. I hadn't thought of a personal code within that. This is just absolutely incredible. Also, I want to give you a real big, like, congratulations, because this podcast goes dark really quickly when we're talking with people, like, about technology, and you just, like, navigated that beautifully, and I still came out, like, positive and happy. So thank you.
I'm not alone in this. I think we have a few folks out there. And I'd be happy to share, you know, references and so on. Folks who are thinking about this more in terms of agency and how we can have increased agency. And yes, the value question is a really important question.
Wow.
I think if I can, like, again, connect to what Mahesh says, I think a really, really good message is because some of these policies that needs to be in place are probably never going to come from the top, just because there is so much interest in like a monetary interest. That's what like Mahesh was talking about earlier, right? The monetary interest is what is messing humans up and is switching our priority to what really should matter, to what we believe it matters, right? A popularity, whatever it is that comes with this technology, right? I think that the really good message is to, in our small settings, like as individuals, as with our family, to really try to regain control of what, I don't know, those moments that really like the little things, right? Honestly, I'm starting to believe that more and more, that eventually I will probably like retire my countryside Italy house and just like do the little things you know that that before was like, oh, I don't want to do that, I want to get out of here and experience, you know, the big city lives and now I'm kind of like I'm not that old, but I'm
you're old,
think about I'm getting older, no white hair yet, but I'm getting older. I'm starting to think the opposite. I'm thinking about how much joy there was like in just planting a seed and see it grow and putting water in it and eating the fruit of my labor, you know?
Absolutely. Quite literally, yes.
But Mahesh, I have one last question, and this one there might not be an answer to, so I know that one. But if all, I don't know, our rules and laws of physics and all of the things within our human existence could be adapted and adjusted for this question, those are all now, those constraints are removed. Is there something you would really like to research that you haven't been able to, I don't know, synthesize into either a hypothesis or something along those ones? Or are you pretty much able, are you doing kind of really where you want to be with it?
Yeah, I think I'm exactly where I need to be.
That's awesome.
And I was exactly where I needed to be 10 years ago, and I was exactly where I needed to be 20 years ago. So this is what it is. If you chase happiness, you might not find it. But if you chase engagement, you will find it. Mm. You have to chase engagement, not happiness. You know, because engagement is a pursuit of both difficulty and competence. It is constantly building something within you and then trying to seek out new challenges, right? And that is when you sort of get to that sweet spot in between. So I think I have been I've been very fortunate, I think, in my life that I have found to be pretty much any time you could sample me, and I think that's where I am. And I'm really happy about it.
I'm absolutely blown away with that. And I think that is a perfect way to end this conversation.
That's
everyone,
a goal for everybody, honestly.
Yeah. Just stay engaged, keep learning, keep searching. And if you ever want, Mahesh will be starting his weekly podcast of just motivational speak. Now, I'm joking, but like in his next career, in his next engagement and moment of flow, then it'll be there.
Thank you.
But truly, this was incredible. And thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much, guys. Thank you for your time and the opportunity.
And thank you for listening to another episode of The Gateway, brought to you by Northern Illinois University, where your future is our focus. And please, remember to love always the promise of tomorrow today.